Backseat Producers, episode 143, Ghost in the Shell. Hey, this is Tony.
And this is Daryl.
And we have a guest.
Christiana.
Yes, we have Christiana Ellis with us. We are the Backseat Producers. And tonight we're going to talk about Ghost in the Shell. That's it. That's what we're talking about.
The anime, the
Ghost in the Shell.
The anime.
Major, I salute you.
All right, so we were just about to go through your litany of this plethora of work that you have in the podcasting universe.
So introduce yourself there, Christiana.
Wow. Okay, I'm Christiana Ellis, probably best known as the author of Nina Kimberly the Merciless, which is a humorous fantasy podcast novel, and of Space Casey, which is a humorous science fiction audio drama miniseries. But I've also done lots of other things, including Christiana's Shallow Thoughts, which was a short podcast that I did every day for a year and then stopped because I regained my senses. I do a podcast about Survivor. I do half a dozen other things when I have time for them. And then we just started a new podcast called Merciless Storytellers, which is a competition for short audio storytelling.
Which I actually joined in on the staff round, which is available
That's
now.
Right.
Which is available now, both for the people listening in the chat room and for the people that will eventually hear this a couple of months from now.
Yes. So mercilessstorytellers.blogspot.com is the website there. And so the idea there is that you listen to the stories. We have judges that provide sort of commentary and critique, but then the listeners actually vote for their favorites. And so right now it's just a demonstration round, but anybody can enter. And when we actually get the first round going, it will be, you know, rounds of five people who have entered, and the winner goes on to the semifinals, and then there's prizes and all sorts of good stuff.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun.
I'm hoping it's good.
So far, it's good. Yeah, if it ends up anything like Pickle Tales was, it's going to be a lot of fun for a lot of people.
I sure hope so.
Because that was something else you did back in the day,
yes,
as it were.
That's right. It is sort of the next, you know, it's Pickle Tales, the next generation.
Yes.
And so Pickle Tales was a podcast that was kind of a similar concept back in 2006. And Tony was actually a contestant there. He got all the way to fourth place, if I recall correctly. And
was on the leaderboard.
That one was a little bit larger in scope, meaning like a cycle of competition took much longer.
Yeah,
these are going to be a little bit faster, but also, you know, a little bit easier to manage, so we can actually repeat them afterwards. Peanut just ran off with my pudding cup. That is like the best thing I've read all day.
Yeah, we've got the chat room going. We've got a couple of folks in the chat room, so
hopefully some more will join into the madness.
Someone listening to this months from now is going to say, "What the hell?"
Christiana just lost her mind. We heard it here first.
Well, no, it just comes and goes.
Yeah,
you know, I just. Like, I don't even try to keep it in anymore.
Oh, I remember. I was on Sci-Fi Smackdown with you. I know.
Oh, that's another thing I did.
We all lost our mind over that.
Yes. So, yeah, I've been around in podcasting since 2005. There's people who have been around longer than me, but I was, you know, I'm back there and, you know, an old hand at this. And So all that just means is that I have lots of abandoned projects.
Yeah. Actually, as of this past weekend, as we record this, this podcast is now 4 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. So, all right. We're going to go ahead and just jump on in.
Okay.
Christiana, since I know how busy you are, I'm pretty sure you're not as familiar with our format as you might otherwise be, because you're busy. You don't have time to listen. But,
well, I've listened to a couple of episodes.
Did you?
Right. But I
wow. did your homework.
You know, I'm reminded of Willard in Apocalypse Now confronting Colonel Kurtz is like, you know, what do you think of my methods? And I'm not sure I see any methods.
Oh, yes, madness.
Yes. Yes, maybe.
So, yeah, the way right. you kind of all set it up there was like there's some kind of a structure, and
well,
I was not able to really glean that.
There is vaguely a structure. Vaguely the structure is that we give our high-level overview. Then we go
okay.
through acting talent, which for an animated movie isn't quite the same.
Well, there's certainly voice work.
There is voice work. And
character
then we
design.
Right. Then we do like a plot summary. If it's a movie that is either not as well known or it's fairly new, we'll take a break before we go into spoiler section. For this, yeah, we're 15 years out, I think, and it's
yeah.
and it's a fairly well known movie in our culture.
Well, plus with the movie like this, I mean, you could have someone explain to you everything that happens, and you still wouldn't
still
know,
don't know
what
the hell's going on.
And I mean that with in the best possible way, with utmost sincerity.
Yes, and tonight we're doing the drink cam for anyone who's in the chat room. No, tonight it is Ghost in the Shell.
Yay!
All right, so what'd you think, Christiana? I'll let you go ahead and start.
This movie is one of my favorites. I mean, to some extent, I actually like the anime series that followed it, Standalone Complex, better. But this movie holds kind of a special place for me because when I first saw it 15 years ago, it blew my fragile little mind. I was a teenager. I was just, you know, we were at the video store and I went up to just look at some other stuff that, you know, is like, well, gee, what else is over here? Ghost in the Shell. That looks kind of interesting. I wonder what that's about. And my parents had no idea what it was, or else they wouldn't have let me get it. And so I got it and I watched it, and it just blew me away. Because, I mean, not only was it this deep, very complex, very sophisticated science fiction story, but there was also blood and nudity.
Yeah.
And
yes, there was.
And lots of violence.
I had never seen anything like it before. When I saw this, and it just completely opened my mind to this whole new universe of entertainment options. And so, in that sense, I have a lot of nostalgia for it, even though I can, you know, with hindsight, I can acknowledge that the movie itself is not perfect. And there are some things that are follow-ups that I actually like better, but oh man, I like it.
Okay. Daryl, what do you got?
Still 15 years later, I still enjoy it. I mean, I was kind of spoiled when I because I'd seen Akira before this had come out, so, and I was pretty much into the anime before this hit the screens. And I, like I say, enjoyed it then, still enjoy it now. You can still see where all its influences came from.
Yeah.
In the chat room, they're talking about Ghost in the Shell 2 Innocence.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that they mentioned that one, because there's, when you compare this movie and some of the other movies and the two seasons of the anime series, it's important for people to know, if they don't already, that the anime series, Standalone Complex, and then Standalone Complex Second Gig, is sort of a parallel reality to this movie, the first movie, and then Ghost in the Shell Innocence, because they have many of the same characters, a very similar setting, but the plots are on completely parallel tracks. You shouldn't try to make them work with each other.
Right, you can't compare. You can't compare the made-for-TV series to these two movies. You'll just confuse yourself. The Innocence and this movie stand alone completely. I mean, well, actually, one is a sequel to the other, but
there's a completely different style
to both of them and a completely different story.
Right. So Innocence is a sequel to this movie. Whereas the Ghost in the Shell Solid State Society movie is a feature follow-up to the anime series.
Okay.
And then there was actually other movie. There were two other features that were essentially they took from each of the two seasons of the anime. The Laughing Man arc, and then I forget what they called the second arc. But they essentially made like... They cut out all of the stuff that was not main story arc, and they made features out of them. But frankly, that's stupid. You should just watch the anime series.
I might want to mention too. This series was a manga long before it was a movie, and the movie was made pretty much from the manga.
Yeah, and there's a credit at the end that that says that it's based on the manga. Mm-hmm. Just for the record, for me, this is my only exposure to the Ghost in the Shell
universe,
at all. I've not read the manga. I've only ever seen this movie. I've not seen anything else. Not the second movie in this cycle, not the series, nothing else.
Well, I echo Chibi there in the sense of saying if you liked this at all, then you absolutely should check out at least the first season of Standalone Complex.
Yeah.
I didn't like the second season as much, but the first season is just, it's amazing. And really, out of the whole universe of Ghost in the Shell stuff, that first season of the anime series is my favorite. I don't own a lot of anime, but I own that.
And I want to mention, too, the music in this is just mind-blowing in itself. I mean, it's one of the better anime soundtracks that are out there.
Oh, I have Tallulah says that her favorite part of Standalone Complex is the first season theme song. I have the soundtrack CD. I love that song. It's, there's a lot of great music on that album.
Well, cool. All right. So, my thoughts on the movie. I actually had different memories of it because I had seen it once, probably in about 96 ish, I remember really enjoying it then. Watching it now, and I know a lot of this comes from being a little more critical because we do this movie podcast thing. I thought that the characters were kind of weak, and the plot was kind of weak, but that's not what this was about at all. So it's hard to fault it for that because that's not really what they were going for. They were going more for this metaphysical discussion.
Yeah, the deep philosophical
means. Yeah, and that I think it succeeded on. And I liked that. If I was watching it just for character and plot, there's really not a lot there because, quite honestly, there's not much of a plot. There is some, but it's pretty light. And it's really there as a window dressing for telling this bigger story. And this really feels like an introduction to something much bigger. And I mean, without being exposed to any of that, my take on just this film is this is the introduction to a world that's much bigger and much more complex. And I want to know more about that world based on this. It still just kind of feels like an introduction to it.
Well, they also leave out a lot of the description. They leave it to the viewer to figure out kind of the backstory and the details that was going on.
And I liked that. I liked that they didn't really talk down to me and try to over-explain anything. And there was some really neat little futuristic ticks in it, I guess you could say. Like at one point, there's a car backing up. And instead of and it had like a straight across brake light bar, and as he's backing up, it was like an LED with the word back. And I thought that was really cool. It's something a little different. It's something, yeah, I can see at some point in the future, something like that would probably become common. So it was a nice little thing that was just kind of a toss in, but it was a nice, it made the world feel bigger and more complex. Right. Yeah. Right.
Well, so I think what you're saying is something I would agree with generally, in the sense that the movie's focus is not on the characters. I mean, the characters are in some ways almost like puppets in order to illustrate the philosophy and story ideas. And yet the story itself has some structural problems.
Yeah.
For example, there's no third act. I mean, that whole big fight sequence with the tank and everything at the end, you feel like you should wake up for that, and then you get the end of the movie. But wait, no, it's then you get the last act of the movie, but then it's just roll credits, and you're like, wait, what?
Right.
I remember that being my reaction the first time I saw it. I was like, wait, what? It's over?
Yeah. I was watching it on Netflix streaming, which mm-hmm. another point, if people are watching, this is available on Netflix streaming, at least as of this recording, it is. Yes. And we're getting to a point where it's like, wow, the story's really finally starting to pick up. And I look down because it's got this little
progress
bar. And it's an hour into the movie, and it's only an hour and 20-minute movie. And there's probably, in my mind, I'm thinking there's probably about 5 minutes of credits, which is pretty typical. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow, this movie's going to wrap up quick.
Right. So, I mean, in some ways, I feel that's kind of why I almost expressed a little bit of hesitation when I was first talking about the movie, that it almost means more to me as being my introduction to the idea of mature manga or anime of any kind. And
I can see that. I can definitely see that.
I feel like I've grown past it, but I still look back on it fondly.
Well, you also, one thing too, anime up to this point had a lot of typical tropes in them, and this one kind of like threw every one of them out the window. I mean, there's no cute girl in here, unless you count the major, but she's made that way. Nobody is very particularly likable. I mean, they're all pretty, even amongst themselves, they treat each other pretty rough.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it's a police drama, and there's no magic girls, there's no aliens invading, there's none of the typical anime tropes that were used up to this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's exactly why it had such a profound impact on me, was just because I had just literally never seen anything like it before. It hadn't even really occurred to me that there was stuff like it, much less having ever seen any. I have to say that not purely on the basis of this movie, but the major, aka Motoko Kusanagi, is one of my favorite characters in anything ever. Although most of that is based on the deeper explorations of who she is that come from the series, more so than the movie itself. The movie, because even within the series, you sort of have to glean all of these character details almost. The story doesn't dwell on them. You have to just sort of be paying attention as things go by. For example, the major is, I suppose you could call it lesbian, although it's a little bit more complicated in the whole scheme of things in this society, but it's just something that is kind of never really made super explicit, but it's there if you're paying attention. Not in this movie, but in the series. But that's just an example of there is a lot more characterization, but you have to be watching for it because it doesn't just, hand feed it to you.
It's kind of like Dumbledore being gay.
Well, actually,
it's more explicit than that.
Well, I've watched all the series too, and I initially got that vibe also, and then it occurred to me, no, she's not lesbian. She's very narcissistic.
Well, see, that's why I kind of also was saying it's a little bit complicated. There's
none of the characters in this thing, none of the characters are exactly what they seem. Mm-hmm. There's lots of red herrings thrown around all over the place to lead you somewhere, and then all of a sudden they do something out of the character which they were doing, and it leads you down another path.
Mr. Chibi makes a great point in the chat room. The side characters have more plot than Section 9 people, like the garbage men at the beginning. And that's a good point, because it's almost a bit like how in 2001, you know, HAL 9000 almost has more emotion in his voice than any of the human characters.
Right.
And, you know, they really humanize the one garbage man especially, just to make it all that more, you know, chilling when you realize this whole thing about his wife and his daughter is all just a false memory implanted in his brain to get him to, you know, to ghost hack these, you know, with these terminals.
Right. Yeah, and it was one of those things that story, I in a way, I was a little disappointed, because I was hoping there would be a little more of that come into play later. And I suppose if the film was longer, if it was handled differently, I mean, it could have, where maybe some of the characters that we've been following through the whole movie, turns out that some of the things they say, they've been ghost hacked, and it is not their reality.
Right. They don't even know if their personalities are what they're supposed to be.
Right, right.
Well, and there's some discussion, too, of just the idea that if all of your memories are just data and data can be manipulated, then it's like, at what point can you ever be sure of anything? You can't, so you kind of just... It's like the discussion... I guess it was Bato and Aramaki, who is like, do you really trust the people who do the maintenance on your cyber brain? And he's just like, well, you know... At some point, you just have to trust.
Yeah, but when you start to doubt, when you start to doubt, you have to. How far do you carry it?
Right.
Exactly.
Who watches the Watchers?
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so obviously they have some regulations in place, but it's never going to be 100% secure
because they're only human.
See, the important thing to remember too is that it's not, you know. When we want to compare it to now, it's not like our memories are completely intact and secure now. I mean, you know, our organic memories are actually fairly unreliable.
Right.
And so, you know, it's just kind of a matter of different, but not necessarily, you know, the flaws you might see in it. It's not like there are no flaws in our current system either. So
as a podcaster who doesn't edit his own shows, when I go back and listen to episodes, like months later, sometimes months or sometimes even years later, I've forgotten that I've said certain things my opinion may have changed about a movie. And, you know, I go back and listen. I said that?
Who
really?
Was that me? Yeah, who
was
that guy behind the microphone using
who
my voice?
That jerk. Man, that guy's a jerk. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Ghost in the Shell was a fantastic movie. There was plot, plenty of plot and character. That guy doesn't know what the hell he's talking about.
He just had to watch it 4 or 5 more times to get all the...
Well, so, the movie, certainly, it's really all about ideas, and so the story and the characters to some extent are really just kind of a framework to drape all of these ideas and concepts on, and yet it does it with this awesome action and just so many little things that, again, I say it just like I did before, is I had never seen anything like it before. Just even the idea of cyberpunk, I had been familiar with some elements of it, but it was such a more vivid portrayal than I had ever seen anywhere, and the action, and just it expanded my horizons.
Yeah, like the one thing that I assumed, but it was I don't ever remember it being made explicit, except maybe during one of their discussions. Batu's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Were those some kind of...
Yeah, they're cybernetic implants.
They're cybernetic implants. I mean, that was an assumption.
Yeah.
But they didn't really go out of their way to say it. And no one reacted oddly to him. I mean, it was that's just the way he is. Well, and it seemed most... very and it seemed very normal to everyone who...
Well, that's one thing that's explicit in the story is lots of people have cybernetic enhancements.
Right.
So to go see some guy walking around with TV lenses sticking out of his head is not terribly unusual.
Right.
I mean, any more so than we'd see people now walking around with Bluetooth microphones in their ears.
Right.
We'd think nothing of that. But, you know, 20 years ago, that would have been considered very strange.
Yeah.
Strange jewelry.
Yeah, it would have been jewelry.
One thing that's explored a bit more in the series, too, is that while it's very common for people to have a lot of these little cybernetic things, just like, you know, people have cell phones or smartphones or laptops or whatever today, you know, it's almost like gadgets. But at certain, it's also true that, like, the very poorest of the society will generally not have them, or they might have, like, really cheapo versions.
Mm-hmm. They'll get what they can afford.
Right. And so it's just it's not made a hunt. You know, they don't spend a lot of time on it. But part of the devil's bargain that they have in working for Section 9 is that they get these super-duper deluxe cyborg bodies that are, you know, the top-of-the-line, best-of-the-best that you could, you know, money is no object sort of thing. But it also means you can't really leave.
There's no retirement plan in Section 9.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's there's you can't, you depend on the maintenance that they can provide for it. And if you wanted to leave, she actually makes this point when after she was, you know, when she was on the boat with Bato after the dive, where she was talking about how not only do you have to give back the body, but you have to give back the memories of what you did with it. And at that point, it's kind of like, if you're giving up the memories of what you did, how are you even the same person anymore? But also kind of, again, you know, from there asking the question, does that matter?
And it's doubly complicated for both Bato and the Major because they have so many replaced parts. In the Major's case, the only things organic of her is her brain case and a part of her spinal column. She asked Bato there explicitly, you know, how much of your body is cybernetic?
Right.
Which he never really says, but she mentions that she's a full body cyborg.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so Chibi again keeps making all these great points. Is that Togusa was the one cop, you know, who liked to use the revolver, and so his deal is that although he had some implants to let him communicate, like with the internet, he was all organic,
flesh. Yeah.
Other than
right.
that. And so,
in fact, they had gotten him just for that reason.
Yeah, and they explore that even more in the series. Just the idea that it would be easy for them to just get a whole bunch of people that are all the same. But the Major is very clear on this idea that, you know, you can't have everybody be all the same, because then whenever there's a blind spot for one person, nobody else would catch it.
Exactly.
And so you need to have people who see things differently, who do things differently.
And have different vulnerabilities, too.
Diversity is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Well, and as we saw even in this, it was, I mean, it wasn't direct, you know, it's not like nobody else could have seen it and he only saw it because he was organic somehow. But he was the one that got suspicious about the two cars in the parking garage and started saying, you know, what was the amount of weight? Mm-hmm. In those two cars.
Because he's,
you know,
the only...
Like, those two guys shouldn't have weighed half a ton. What's going on there?
Well, remember, he's also the one member who is a police officer. So he has probably a lot more street smarts than the others, which come out of... the Major comes out of the military, and I assume Bato and the others do, too. But none of them have any really police investigative experience.
Mm-hmm. Bato was, I think... Black Ops in the military. He there was a war in South America that he did a bunch of stuff for. I don't remember what the Major's they talk about her backstory when she was she got her full cyborg body very young, like as a child,
yeah.
You know, like seven. And so she's had a complete cyborg body ever since then. And so she is a little bit unusual in that sense. They kind of make it clear that a lot, you know, even people who do go full cyborg usually don't do it that young. But I don't remember if they've spent much time on kind of the in-between period there.
No, they didn't. It's only in the anime, in the TV series do they bring up more of the Major's backstory. Here, it's just we assume that the Major is she's called the Major for apparently a good reason, but you never really explain why she has the rank she does. It'd be beyond usual for a police officer to be referred to as Major all the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But she's just such a cool character. I think one of the things that I like about her character is that she's almost competent to a fault, which is a weird thing to say, maybe. But she's so good at everything that to some extent her weakness tends to be almost overestimating herself. Because so much of the time she is more than a match for anything that she goes up against, that those rare times where it might be a little bit more than she can handle by herself, she still tends to rush in all alone.
And, you know, ripping your own arms off.
Well, right. I mean, at that point she couldn't count on Bato showing up with his special gun.
Right.
And so she was just doing anything she could think of to try to take out this tank.
Well, the thing is, when you're a super soldier and have a strength of multiple humans, I mean, you tend to get a tad overconfident, or at least you don't.
Yeah.
Your limitations are tend to surprise people. I'm going to ask you a question here, too. This came up during Anime St. Louis. We had a panel with Ellen Stein, who's Richard Epcar's wife. And she's a voice actor, too. She's voiced a bunch of miscellaneous voices in the Ghost in the Shell series, but the title of the panel was called Women in Voice Acting, and one of the first questions she asked the audience in general was, who are your female heroes? And of course the audience was kind of like flabbergasted on that, because they don't tend to think in terms of female heroes in anime too readily, even though there are quite a few, they just don't pop to mind. So I threw out Major Kusanagi, and she replied back that she was really not a female hero. She was a woman acting in a man's body. Would you say that essentially the Major is a strong female character? I would tend to think my own feelings is yes, she's probably one of the stronger female characters in anime.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I can see what she's getting at there. Because that is certainly something that can happen, is the idea of, in order to make a female character tough, you essentially just have them act like a man. But I don't really think... I think her character is more well-developed than that. I mean, maybe not in this movie specifically, but to imply that she just acts like a man, well, she doesn't. She doesn't act like a man, she acts like the Major. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so this is who she is. And to be sure, you know, with her, gender gets a little bit complicated. I mean, there's an episode in the series where Bato actually asks, you know, when you keep replacing your body, how come you keep replacing it with that same one? Why don't, you know, people would respect your authority more if you got a male body. And implying that it's really, I mean, and it really is just that. You know, it's really a matter of choice. I mean, she could look like anything she wants to look like.
Well, that's one thing I think her reply was. It says because keeping a female body tends to throw all her enemies off balance.
Well,
they don't expect a diminutive woman like the Major to be a super soldier.
But see, the other element of that they really kind of left fairly oblique was that she had this watch. From that was of high sentimental value to her, and I don't remember if they ever explained exactly where she got it, but clearly it was important to her, and it fit on just perfectly on her female wrist. And so in context with all of that, there was kind of this implication that maybe she keeps looking like that because that's what the watch fits with. And I don't mean it just as simple as the pragmatic of, you know, like she couldn't get the watch strap extended. You know what I mean? I just mean in the sense that the watch means something to her.
And she's, you know, it's part of her identity.
It's part of that.
Yeah, right. It's something that she can identify. She identifies with and kind of would like to mold herself around rather than having to mold it around her.
Perhaps it being from so, like a parent or grandparent or, you know, someone influential in her life before, basically before she became cybernetic. Mm-hmm. And it's just a carryover from that. This is just rank speculation from someone who's only ever seen the movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I mean, it's implied that it's something like that. They just never make it entirely clear. I hesitate to give spoilers for the anime series, but there's a crucial scene where you think something has happened, and then later it's revealed that you were wrong. But there is a clue to the truth even when it happens, because essentially she's not wearing her watch in that scene. Mm. And I could explain more fully, except it's kind of a major spoiler of the first season.
Go watch
not
the
a
series.
Problem. Not, yeah. Hey, dummy, go watch the series. Yeah, I've heard that before. Yeah. the last time I heard that, I watched Lost. I started January 24th and caught up in the middle of April.
Wow.
I started with season one, episode two, because I had actually seen the pilot before that. But I started at the end of January, and I am caught up. I caught up in April.
He was a trooper.
By the time
he did
this
it every
posts,
night.
It might be all over. But
yeah, that's true.
Record this on Cinco de Mayo. Last night's episode was messed up.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. No spoilers. I'm not going to spoil anything because I don't know if everybody in the chat room knows. So do you have it? Since we've broached Lost, do you have any theories?
Oh man. Well, you know, I feel like theorizing is almost beside the point right now, because I feel like they've pretty much explained what they're gonna.
Maybe.
And now it's just a matter of, okay, what, you know, given the context of what we've been told, what's gonna happen now? I don't think we're gonna get a lot more in the way of answers.
Yeah.
Except for some of the loose threads, like who's that little kid on the island now?
Right.
And, you know, but I think mostly it's just going to be, like, from this point forward, what's going to happen? I don't think we're going to get a lot more backstory-type answers. I think when Jacob talked about the wine bottle, that was pretty much as detailed an explanation as we're ever going to get.
Probably. I still think it's all virtual reality. It's either virtual reality or there's an alien spaceship under the island, one of the two. That's just me. It could be both. It very well could be the alien spacecraft is projecting virtual reality onto those individuals. Perhaps.
Or maybe the Earth spirit has captured the crashed alien spaceship and is giving it dream visions.
That could be it as well. That's even cooler and wackier.
And then, what if the Earth spirit, its very existence is dependent on the beliefs of its followers, and therefore its reality is dictated by them, and so it really only thinks that it's giving the crashed alien spaceship.
Oh my God, it's the never-ending story.
And then you pull back more, and it's all a snow globe on somebody's mantle.
Yeah. Yeah, I really have a feeling that that this one is going to kind of go the way of Battlestar Galactica, where it's more about the characters and seeing how the characters resolve more than it's about seeing how the plot resolves.
Rosebud.
Yes. Well, and you know, I'm an apologist for the finale of Battlestar Galactica.
I loved it. I thought it was perfect. I really did.
I definitely understand, you know, the people who didn't like it. I understand where they're coming from.
But
I think that their expectations were out of whack. I think that they had it, a lot of people had it in their mind that they were going to get some sort of a coherent, logical explanation to the plot questions, when it seemed pretty clear to me from the beginning of the show that that's not what it was interested in.
No, no.
I mean, you know, and if you listened to the, like, the podcast commentaries for the episodes, you know that he didn't even know who the final five Cylons were going to be until, like, halfway through plotting season three or something like
right.
that. And so, I mean, the idea that there was really going to be some coherent thing that just wrapped up everything at the end, I thought that was just kind of an unrealistic expectation to have.
Yeah.
And so I will agree with Stingray in the chat room that the very last bit where it fast-forwarded to present day was – that maybe was unnecessary. I didn't mind it per se, but I think it was probably unnecessary.
I thought it was a nice little nudge in the ribs. Mm-hmm. Hey, look what we did.
Yeah.
Maybe it went just a half a step too far, but I like what Shibby says, though. Hurley is a luck dragon.
Yes, clearly.
All right, so let's go ahead and try.
The robot chicken never-ending story, never-ending party skit is one of my favorite ever.
I have not seen that.
There's at one point, there's Bastion is dancing with the child princess and child empress, childlike empress, and he's spanking her, and she's going, "Say my name, Bastion! Say my name!"
That's fantastic.
And then he just goes, "Hi-ya-ya-ya!" Because no one knows, but yeah,
yeah. My son is 7 years old, and we're in the midst of reading the Neverending Story.
I never read the book.
I had never read the book until I'm reading it to him. So this is my first experience with actually reading the book.
Presumably, it does actually end.
There is a limited number of pages in this tome. I'll let you know how it goes.
You say
when I get
that
there.
It's enchanted. You're just going to keep
this
turning
book just
and you
keeps
never
getting
get any
longer
further.
And longer.
Yes, it is a book.
It is a book made
from dead trees with things
and you,
called
and you
words
forward
in
a
them.
Few pages, and then you say, and then the father flipped forward a few pages in the book to see if it was actually going to end.
Yeah.
And then he realized that the book was describing exactly what he was doing right then.
Now somebody told me, and we haven't gotten this far into it, but somebody told me that the movie only really represents like the first half of the book. Huh. So,
and the funny thing about
these, they did make two sequels to the movie.
They did?
Yeah.
That
are best friends.
I knew that there was a Neverending Story 2. I didn't realize there was
Jack Black was in the third one.
Really?
Wow. He's a high school bully.
That's fantastic.
And the really thing fun about these book things is as you read them, the pictures, they form in your mind. It's really amazing.
It's quite stunning.
It's in Technicolor too, and you can hear the voices.
You can and actually somebody in the chat room is saying that they didn't realize it was a book. You can get it on Amazon. It's pretty easy to pick up. And one of the cool little ticks about the book is every chapter starts with there's 26 chapters. Each one starts with a new letter of the alphabet and they're sequential.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So that seems like a completely unnecessary gimmick to me, but
that's a nice gimmick.
For a children's book, it's actually kind of a fun gimmick because it helps a 7-year-old keep track of how far along we are in the book.
Yeah.
What chapter are we on?
I can see that.
Chapter F. Okay.
Well, you know what you have to check out next though is the book of The Princess Bride, which is fantastic.
Except I don't like The Princess Bride. I'm that guy.
Wow.
Yeah, I am the guy who doesn't like The Princess Bride. No, we did read The Hobbit, though. We did. We read that. That is a fantastic read for kids.
Fantastic read for anybody.
It actually works really well as each chapter is a self-contained story. Mm-hmm. So it's really nice for a bedtime book because you can just read one chapter a night and you get a beginning, middle, and end. So it ties everything up nicely and most of them end in just a little bit of a cliffhanger so you're kind of excited to find out what happens next.
I'm just still sad.
I know.
Like Princess Bride.
Yeah. Well, for me, it was one of those
What's
things
wrong
that,
with you?
It was overhyped. I know that that's what it was. It was overhyped.
Well, yeah, I can see that. I mean, honestly, I can't separate the actual movie from my nostalgia of it. So I, you know, if I were to watch it for the first time today, I doubt that I would enjoy it as much as I enjoy it watching it the, you know, 507th
time. Yes, Chibi, I am always disagreeing. That's my lot in life.
Fellow. Most disagreeable indeed.
It's my lot in life.
Well, racing back to our original premise here of Ghost in the Shell.
Oh, we were talking about that, weren't we?
We were just talking about that a minute ago. We were pretty much talked about all of its deep philosophical meanings here and whatnot, but few people have maybe not realized what the plot of the story was all about anyway.
All right. Shall I summarize?
Yeah,
go for it.
All right, then. So we begin with following the Major, who is a secret agent type individual for an organization known as Section 9, which operates in, I forget which city the movie actually takes place in, but it's, you know, China / Japan of the future. And she is basically taking out a diplomat, foreign diplomat, so that he cannot grant political asylum to an important hacker programmer.
Right.
And so it seems unrelated at the time to what's going on later, which is the investigation into a Uber hacker known as the Puppet Master, who is called that because he hacks into people's brains and makes essentially them do what he wants to have happen. So he doesn't ever have to do anything himself. He gets other people to do it by hacking their brains. And so they're investigating that because obviously they can't just let that go. They manage to follow a trail that is a little bit suspicious because of how good he's been at evading capture up to that point, and yet it's, you know, as good as they are at chasing him, it seems like it's almost a little bit too easy. But then it doesn't work anyway. So then they discover there's this new cyborg that's just been wandering around, gets hit by a truck. So they bring it in, and it becomes clear that a rival agency, Section 6, which is supposed to be their ally, but they squabble because they're family. And it becomes clear that Section 6 created this artificial intelligence to be essentially a cyber spy, to, you know, spy on people through the internet. It became self-aware, and so in order to try to recapture it, they trapped it into a cyborg body, and that's the body that Section 9 found. But then Section 6 breaks in, steals it back, and the Major, who has become obsessed with the idea of the self-aware artificial intelligence because of her own existential crisis about her own humanity, is determined to get it back and dive into it to find out what's going on. There's a big battle with a tank and a special gun, and she pulls her own arms off, and then she merges with the Puppet Master and ends up in a little girl cyborg body, and then the net is vast and limitless.
We might want to mention that when she merged with the Puppet Master, they became something more than what each other was.
Yes, like Starchild at the end mm-hmm. of 2001.
So the Major, at the very end, the Major both finds what she's looking for and is now more or less has her own little existential crisis resolved.
Incidentally, that is essentially the difference in the two parallel realities of the movies and the series, is that doesn't happen in the series.
Right. The series is more of a continuing drama.
Yeah. Which, surprisingly enough, for an anime series.
But each one of the episodes brings up another philosophical point about about living in a.
Oh yeah, sorry.
About living in a society that has been somewhat has sort of lost its humanity because of all the amount of artificial enhancements.
Well, and I think one of the interesting themes that it brings up, especially in this movie, almost less so this particular theme in the series, but in the movie it definitely brings up the idea that the technology has allowed, you know, mankind to do all of these things that essentially does mean that it is leaving its humanity behind, and that's scary and seems at sort of first glance like a bad thing. But then sort of also just recognizing that it's not really inherently a bad thing. It's just a matter of fearing change.
Well, yeah, because at the very end, the Major has now become a new being. She's one that's
right.
built. She's one that's specifically built now to live in the information grid.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's like when the puppet master's proposing the merge describes it as like neither of us will, you know, both of us will change, but neither will lose anything.
They become the MCP.
End of line.
By the way, the Facebook episode of South Park was awesome.
Haven't seen it. Can't speak to that.
Have to hit Comedy Central here.
It's online. You can watch that.
You can watch all the South Park episodes. I got to catch up on a bunch of them.
You have zero friends.
You've got time now, though.
Yes, I got plenty of time now. I've got an enforced vacation.
I watched so much television during my vacation.
See, that's what I'm trying to avoid. Unlike most people, I don't watch that much TV. I spend too much time building electronic projects and learning to build microcontrollers and robots and, you know, all that weird stuff.
Fun stuff.
Yeah. One of these days, I will complete my 10-foot-tall cybernetic killing machine.
Oh, noes.
That can both. And I shall
I'm gonna have to avoid that panel at Archon.
Then I shall set it. Then I shall set it free to mow the yard continuously.
There you go. All right. Well, I think we talked through most of this.
Did you like my story summary?
It was very comprehensive.
Fantastic. You missed the boobies, though.
There were boobies. You're right that I kind of skipped over that. It might be worth discussing that there is a release known as Ghost in the Shell 2.0.
Right.
Which I bought the Blu-ray of it.
Oh, really?
Yes. And it actually has both versions. But the 2.0, essentially what it is it's a remaster of the film, but also they changed some scenes to include new CGI animation instead of the original.
Really?
Animation.
How does that look?
Awful most
really?
Of the time.
That's a
well,
shame.
It's frustrating because it's a mixed bag. The remaster looks fantastic. It looks great. It's much improved most of the movie. But the few places that they have the CGI, there's a couple places where it looks okay. But there's also a couple of places where you're just like, why did they do this? It looked fine before. This is distracting. It looks different from the rest of the movie.
That's unfortunate.
It's kind of like the special editions of the Star Wars movies, is that there's lots of parts of it that, you know, like a lot of the movie looks cooler in many ways.
Right.
And there's elements of the new stuff that you like, but then there's also elements where you're just going, what?
Yeah, like cutting out the matting around the ships flying around in Empire, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I liked the windows onto the clouds in Cloud City.
Yeah, that was nice.
Yeah, but, you know, the adding a scream when Luke, drops off of the gantry after, you know, having him scream as he falls, I'm like, excuse me, what?
Why? Yeah. Why would you do that?
Okay, let me give you this story here I got from Richard Epcar on the version 2.
Uh-oh.
Okay, Epcar essentially said that the director of Oshi was very dissatisfied with how the original Ghost in the Shell came out. And he always wanted to do a remaster of it. And the remaster was done under his direction. He hated the way the colors were all muddied from the transfers and whatnot. He was totally dissatisfied with the whole way the whole thing came out.
Yeah, and I'll agree that the version that I saw, which the streaming version on Netflix you get is the original
VCR version. But the thing is, though, the colors that were originally done in it were way too dark. It was not what he wanted. It's just the way it came out, and that added sort of to the film noir ambience of it. But that was somewhat unintentional. It's supposed to be a lot brighter, and that's one of the things they corrected in all the colors in the entire remake.
And that definitely looks better. I mean, so I wish that they could have just done that part and then left the new CGI out of it.
Well, again, that was the director's decision there to add, to update things. I know, I mean, he'd already had a bad example again with Spielberg, so I guess he decided, well, if he can do it, I can do it. So, because he was, again, trying to update this for an audience 15 years later. Who maybe
what
has only seen it for the first time.
What I approve of, though, is that the Blu-ray includes both versions.
Oh, that's nice. That's good.
Yeah. That's all I can ask for. You know, I kind of wish they could have done the remaster without the new CGI stuff, but at least they include both versions. Because, you know, like, on the other hand, with the Star Wars movies, you essentially have George Lucas who's, like, doing his darndest to try to make the original versions not exist anymore.
Oh, they're still there. One question I had about that, I understand, and I may have just misread this, but was the dialogue changed, or was it just
I think some of it was re-recorded, because the sound was remastered also, but I don't really know the details of that. That's just what I gleaned from reading the back of the package.
Okay.
So I don't really know the details there, but
they may have just done a better job with the voiceovers, because going back to them now, the voice actors 15 years later, they're going to have some changes in there.
Yeah,
but they just may have done a better cleanup of the soundtrack.
Well, I also don't know which track they're talking about, because like when I rewatched it today, I watched it in the Japanese track with the subtitles. I've watched it both ways. But as far as, you know, that remaster or redoing some of the lines, I don't know which ones they're talking
about. Right, yeah.
I guess it's probably the English one just because it's the American release, but...
It would have been funny if they would have redone some of the Japanese lines for the American release.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
I think we probably covered it. And, of course, there is a sequel to this movie, Innocence,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is a completely... well, it is a sequel, and it picks up the story of what happened after, and it's more of a Bato story than anything else.
It's weird. I like it, but in a lot of ways, I think it's more interesting than good.
Well, let's put it this way: the movie is pure eye candy. I mean, if you just took away the story and just watched it with the soundtrack on a good TV and a good stereo. It's just pure eye candy. I mean, you can just buzz out to it.
And so there's definitely that going for it, and there's some interesting ideas in the story, but ultimately it left me a little bit underwhelmed, especially since I saw it after I had already been exposed to the standalone Complex series, which, like as I've said before, is absolutely my favorite of all of the Ghost in the Shell stuff.
Okay. Foul Sorceress in the chat room has updated us, corrected us, if you will, so drink you. 2.0 has the same dub as the original U.S. release. The Japanese tracks got a cleanup, but there's no major changes to the audio.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, the sound did sound really good. That's the track that I listened to when I watched it today. It sounded really good.
So apparently they had the good master tapes from 95 and may have recorded them on digital tape.
Well, and one of the nice things, too, is that because this actually was a feature film, they were able to, you know, they had the you know, hi-fi audio and the you know, the picture quality that can be looked good on a Blu-ray, as opposed to, you know, some of the TV anime series were never made in HD, and so
their budgets are more limited, too.
Yeah, it was.
Well, I mean, you could, but they wouldn't look any better than.
Right, right. Yeah, it's funny. I saw this discussion probably about a year and a half ago, and on Twitter, and it was somebody was asking. They thought it was weird because how can you show old movies in high def on HD channels? How is that possible? It's like, well. They were on film.
35 millimeter film has a lot better resolution.
Which
than
is
HD.
Better resolution?
Well, and
than
a lot of those originals are on 70 millimeter. You could
right. Yeah, the real old stuff is on the 70 millimeter, so it's really nice.
And film 35 millimeter film is always going to beat HD's resolution by several orders of magnitude. It's
right.
What
yeah.
kills and it so, is just the transfer process.
Yeah.
Right. Although it's interesting that. One of the things that is kind of an issue, starting to be an issue as we go away from actually using celluloid film, is this whole idea of 24 frames per second
mm-hmm.
in movies. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, yes, for the most part, you don't really notice a flicker. But if you watch 24 frames per second and then you watch it at 60 frames per second, you can tell the difference.
That's true. And you know, since we're on this topic, one of the things that I actually listened to the commentary track on Braveheart, which I know some people actually don't like that movie, which is weird. They need to be punched. But
I didn't hear what movie.
Braveheart.
Braveheart,
okay. Yeah. The original commentary track on it is Mel Gibson, and it's basically like it's very dry, but it's very interesting because he talks about some of the filming styles he used for certain scenes. And one of the things that just my naivety and not having, you know, really worked in film and video work, I didn't realize that the way they get those really cool slow motion effects is they use super high speed film. And so he was talking about a lot of that and kind of walking through it. And that's how, like, the scene where he's bashing that guy in the head and, you know, like, opens his skull up. That's all shot in high-speed film specifically for some of those action sequences so they can have them running really fast or then slow them down to catch moments like that. It's actually a very cool kind of like a primer for film school to understand how some of those film effects work.
Also a good primer of when not to use them.
GB has a good point that, you know, film has a grain and a speed. So, I mean, if something is made on film at 24 frames per second, you don't want to change that. I mean, you should be presenting it in the format that it was made in.
Right.
But at the same time, my point was more that when you're making new stuff, it doesn't necessarily make any sense to continue using celluloid at 24 frames per second. But then a lot of movies are being made digital now. But see, then you start getting to some of these, like even the computer animated movies, they're still being shown at 24 frames per second, which doesn't even, I mean, there's no need for it to be that way.
Yeah.
Well,
except
until
that's kind of what people are used to.
Well, it's no, just until the last film projector dies, we'll still be doing it. It's a matter more of getting the theaters to upgrade their projectors than anything else.
Well, a lot
else.
Of them do. I mean, my local theater has the new digital projectors.
Right, but not all of them do. All the newer ones do, but there's still some. Well, I should say one thing. Our little art house here in St. Louis, the Tivoli, the very old style cinema,
mm-hmm.
does have all digital projectors, which is really strange. They were one of the first to get them
mm-hmm.
because they were part of the landmark theater chain, and that was owned. Landmark was owned by Mark Cuban, who was a very big proponent of HD.
It's also,
so
but it's also how
all his.
It's
theaters.
Also how that theater can get a lot of the art house stuff mm-hmm. as cheaply as they do because
right.
the distribution on digital stuff is completely different.
Right, right. They have actually a Win 2000 server up there, which actually they get it over a fiber optic connection,
mm-hmm.
and it's stored on that server. And it's projected, streamed over to the projectors.
And that's very cool.
Yeah, you wouldn't expect, you know, a little art house theater, three-screen art house theater, to have one of the most sophisticated projection and film distribution systems that even the big guys don't have.
Yep.
All right. I got nothing else to say.
I think we've wrapped this one up there.
My drink is all done.
Right. And he's out of tequila now, so he'll have to stop.
Oh, I'm not out of tequila.
Well, he's just, out of his glass.
My glass is empty. That's, I still have plenty of tequila. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Christiana, thank you very much for joining us this evening. We really appreciate
it. Thank you for having me. It's been fun. And I love this movie. So.
Yep.
I'm glad it was one of the options available to me from the big list of films.
Mm-hmm. Yes. There is quite a big list. And anybody can check that out at the website. There's a link right at the top for Big List O Movies, and you can suggest movies to add to the list. The list never seems to get any smaller.
Yes, Ghost in the Shell has moved from the Big List of Movies to the Big List of Edits.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it has. All right. Well, thanks. And, you know,
everyone go listen to Merciless Storytellers and then vote for your favorite.
Absolutely. Yay. Absolutely.
Ta-da!
You know, one thing that in listening to other podcasts recently, I realized we don't really have a sign-off. So I'm just going to go ahead and use our tagline.
Okay.
We're going to leave it with, never forget, it's better in the backseat.
That's right. Join us there.